The Science Show on Radio National. And so we come to that fellow who produces his own alcohol internally, though he hadn't chosen to be so inflicted. And the cure is equally diverting. Meanwhile, in your own biome, how many different creatures or microorganisms do you imagine you have in your long gut? I asked Professor Nandita Garud at the University of California, Los Angeles.
No, in fact, if you want to know how many microbes are in our guts, people have actually tried to quantify that.
And found what?
It's roughly on the order of 10 to the 13.
Which in real language is what?
A lot.
Trillions.
Yes, and we can actually try to understand the most common prevalent bacteria in our guts because they're the easiest to sample. And we can try to understand how are they evolving. So it's not an entire black box and sea of data. There are approaches to start to understand this data.
And are they affected very much on what we happen to eat? Would the biome change fairly quickly, do you think?
Yes and no. So scientists have found that bacteria do change, especially if you travel to countries like India. People get traveler's diarrhea, for example, and they've noticed an uptick in the amount of antimicrobial resistance genes, say, in your gut. However, one really nice feature about our gut microbiomes is that they're also really stable. So while they might endure perturbations, they can rebound back to their original state. If you hit a microbiome with antibiotics, it can actually rebound back to its original state. And this is, I think, a good thing for us because what has worked for us will stay with us, even while we go through perturbations.
Now, when we come into those foods, obviously heard about on programs such as The Health Report with Norman Swan, the ultra-processed foods. What makes a food ultra-processed in your definition?
My understanding is that there are additives to these foods and they have these special carbohydrates that allow them to last far longer than a fresh fruit, for example, would last. They include foods that have syrups, that are chips, sodas, etc., and just are really things that you wouldn't grow in your garden.
You grow them in a factory instead, with all sorts of unusual things happening to them. But will they affect the biome in a way that you can study yourself?
So I think that this is an active area of research. And what we are starting to find is that there are lifestyle and diet changes in industrialized populations that have changed the genetic composition of our gut microbiota. I don't know on what time scale this occurred. I don't know if a person who suddenly one day starts eating ultra-processed foods will suddenly see that adaptation. But I think this is a collective change that has accumulated in our populations over several decades. So what we're noticing is there are special adaptations that have risen to high frequency in these bacteria and have traversed the industrialized parts of the world and are absent from non-industrialized parts of the world. And that these adaptations are at loci or positions in the genome that are responsible for digestion of carbohydrates. One particular case study that we found was case study at a genetic position that encodes a gene that can digest a compound called maltodextrin. When we came across this, we didn't know what maltodextrin is. But my intrepid PhD student, Richard Wolff, fabulous reader, and he found that it's a compound commonly added to ultra-processed foods. If this is truly an adaptation to industrialized diets, then this adaptation should be absent from non-industrialized populations. And he found that indeed that was the case.
And the point about the interesting aspect of the science is one, but also we are affected so much, even with our brain working and so on, behavior by the makeup of that microgenome, as you call it. And so tracking that is very important, but with so many bits, how do you begin to sort them out in your work that you're doing now?
That's what fascinates me. So as we said, the microbiome is very complex. You have 10 to the 13 cells. of which there are at least 100, maybe up to 1,000 different species, of which there are many strains of the same species, of which there are tens of thousands of genes within each species. People call the microbiome our second genome. And it's this other part of us that's super complex and super dynamic, and we don't really know what it's doing. And my former postdoctoral advisor, Katie Pollard, she likes to say, we're in the era of the year 2000 when the human genome was just completed. And we didn't know what those genes were doing in the human genome. And so we're starting to discover that in the microbiome. And so we can use many bioinformatics techniques to start simplifying and whittling down the data. But once we have something that looks like a nice genome, we can start to think about what are the processes that are changing these genomes and try to look for those signatures in the data that allow us to see what we are after. So in the case of adaptation, we're looking for something that's passing from genome to genome or host to host. And so we expected that this should have a fair bit of homogeneity despite there being a sea of heterogeneity in the surrounding parts of the genomes.
How do you then begin to apply that knowledge apart from doing simple things such as people at home learning what the ultra-processed foods might be with their mysterious ingredients and trying to have more straightforward foods?
So I want to clarify one thing that I have been pondering for a long time. I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing that we have adaptations in our gut in response to ultra-processed foods. Maybe it's actually a good thing. It's enabling us to actually digest those foods that we have access to. And so I wouldn't worry if your gut microbiome looks more industrialized versus non-industrialized. Maybe that's okay. And it's just adapted to what you have on hand.
I love the common sense in what you just said.
Right. So
we've got to apply common sense when we're buying our food.
Exactly. And so I think the microbiome is one readout of our health and what's going on. People have shown the connection between our diets and all sorts of other facets of our health, like our mental health. And so if you feel strong and good and your doctor is giving you a thumbs up, I think you should keep going. But again, if you feel like you could improve, then you don't need a microbiome readout to tell you that. You can probably make those choices.
One example of the complexity of digestion and such like, story I came across the other day, which I think you know about, which is a guy somewhere, I think in Britain, whose gut produced its own alcohol. And then they decided to treat it by giving him a fecal transplant. In other words, someone else's poo provided. Did it work?
Yes, that's a really fascinating story. It's called auto-brewery syndrome. And
auto-brewery. In other words, you're making your own grog.
Exactly. And it's unfortunate for the individual who has the syndrome because they're basically drunk all the time. And it really impedes their quality of life. But indeed, they gave a fecal microbiome transplant. And as far as I understand, this is not a trivial thing to do because you need to clean out the microbiome of the person's gut. And so sometimes when you give a donor's microbiome, you don't know what's going to happen to the resident microbiome. Maybe the resident microbiome might stick around even if you try to clean it out with antibiotics, and it might outcompete the invading microbiome. Or maybe the invading microbiome might actually succeed. And so I think the feat that these doctors achieved was quite remarkable.
Indeed. I think one of the pioneering works was on was it Clostridium difficile?
Yes, C. difficile is one of the pathogens that can cause gastrointestinal distress, and fecal microbiome transplants commonly work for C. difficile infections. So seeing FMTs work in other contexts is very nice.
Wonderful work. What does that teach you finally about how evolution works?
Well, I think we're still joining the two areas of work, translational and then also evolutionary studies. One day, what I think would be wonderful is if we could inform what kinds of fecal microbiome transplants people are receiving using evolutionary guided principles. So, for example, if we know that there's a special gene that's adaptive and perhaps could even help the human host that we're trying to help, then we could select strains to include in the fecal microbiome transplant that has that adaptation, instead of just randomly grabbing anyone's poop from a so-called healthy individual and giving it to that person.
Your intestinal genome, a continuing story. Incidentally, I turned out to have 10 trillion microorganisms in my tummy, and I suspect you're the same. And there's also a hierarchy of best fecal donors, according to the New Scientist magazine, and the best are often selected for further donations. Nadita Garud is Associate Professor at University of California, Los Angeles.